lovely to see you from up here. My name is Suri Gupta, for those who don't know me. And I'm giving a series of two talks this week and next week, part one, part two. I was asked to give a title and I straight away just said freedom. And then actually I was being interviewed by the magazine that we have here. And it was one of those interviews where they sort of give you sort of random questions where they're just trying to find out a little bit about you. So one of the questions was, if you were going to have a dinner party and you could invite anyone, you know, you wanted to, alive or not, who would you invite? You know that question. So actually, I knew immediately who I wanted to invite. And I realised I'd probably have invited them, in my imagination many times before, these particular individuals. The topic is freedom. And I'm imagining we're having a dinner party. Okay, so I thought, well, what do you have at a dinner party? Well, you firstly try and create a nice ambience, don't you? You try and create a nice atmosphere because you want everyone to feel comfortable. So I kind of thought, well, yes, there'd be nice music playing. And the music I would have would be a combination of some jazz piano, a sitar, and African kora. They'd sort of interweave each other, these tunes and these music and these styles. And they'd be very soulful music. They play very soulful music, very heart-opening music. But you can also carry on with a conversation, that type of music. But you can insert your own type. That's mine. And I also thought I'd have obviously some nice aromas, so maybe some incense and some oils there. I probably would like to be somewhere warm, sort of like the tropics where you can hear various insects. Maybe it's mid-evening or something like that. And obviously good food, very good food, healthy, nutritious food and drink. So, and I thought all of that, that's what you do actually when you've got an honoured guest. When you have an honoured guest, you create an atmosphere where they will feel valued, but also you'll be very receptive to their presence. So in a way, that's kind of what we try and do when we do puja, actually. We're sort of creating an atmosphere and inviting a presence into being. So we do that for our imagination. So we've got this dinner party, and my first honoured guest would be, for those of you who know me, won't be any surprise, it would be Martin Luther King. So he's my first honoured guest. So I can't remember when I actually first encountered King. He's always sort of been there somehow in my consciousness, even from as a child. I remember his name being mentioned in our house, and it was always done with a sort of real, almost like a hushed tone, like a reverence almost. Sometimes it felt a bit poignant, like there was a slight sadness too. And obviously later on I discovered, well, he had been assassinated, so maybe that's why, it had that sort of feel to it. But so very early on I was aware of this person called Martin Luther King, and it was a bit later when I discovered, when he began to teach me, I felt like, he was my first guide. He was my first guide and teacher who spoke to me of freedom. And freedom was very, I was very conscious of freedom from a very young age, or the desire for it, probably in its absence. So if I remember at the age of 6, I fell off the climbing frames at school, and I was probably slightly concussed without realising. I remember walking home and looking around my environment as if I was there for the very first time. It was almost like I woke up, like before that I'd been in some kind of sleep. And suddenly I woke up and I looked around where I was walking down the road. And my whole response was one of, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. And what I saw was firstly a very heavy greyness. It was a grey English day. So I felt there was a very heavy grey clouds. I saw people looking quite weary. almost sort of miserable or just weary. There was a weariness I saw on many people's faces. So you've got to remember, I'm 6 years old. So in a way, you're kind of looking at adults and you're thinking, they don't look that happy walking down the street. And then my senses were assaulted because there was a smell of, well, there was just this horrible smell. And I didn't know what it was, but I heard people talking about that there was a dead dog around the corner. In East London in those days, you would get that kind of thing. There'd be dogs that would just die and they'd be there for a while. And then the smell would go and then you'd hear, oh yeah, the council's picked that dog up. So there was this, my senses were assaulted by that. And then there was a graffiti on the wall, and it was racist graffiti on the wall. Although I didn't know that then, all I knew was that it was not friendly. I knew it was something about me. But I knew, and I didn't know what it meant, but I knew it wasn't friendly and I somehow didn't feel welcome. So that was a kind of I woke up into that sort of a environment, and my immediate feeling was, I don't want to be here. I want to find a way out. And so in a way, although freedom wasn't the word that was in my mind, this wanting to find a way out, was sort of indicative of a desire for freedom. And it was also a desire for beauty as well. There was something around, well, this isn't very nice, actually. There must be something else. There must be more to the life or to the world than this. So the freedom and beauty are quite linked in my mind, actually, from quite a young age. I wanted out, I wanted there to be something different, and I certainly didn't want to be defined by what I felt I was being defined by. Somehow or other, waking up to that, I sort of felt, well, is this something to do with me? Is this what I deserve somehow? Or is this going to limit me or define me? I sort of suddenly felt very constrained by my environment. So that was my first sort of waking up. So at some point or other, I sort of learnt about Martin Luther King, his words really spoke to me because he was talking about oppression. And I sort of recognised this sort of very heavy feeling that I had, you know, the sort of greyness, the sort of being unwelcome on some level. I sort of experienced that, well, that must be what oppression is. It's a feeling that you can't be yourself, or the situation is not enabling you to be who you think you might be deep down inside. Yeah. So yes, I was very attracted to this, to what he said about freedom. He actually made it. He said it was possible to be free. That was the first thing. He said it was possible to be free, and he was talking to people who suffered really. Really, really harsh treatment in America, and violent treatment at that time when he was speaking. And he was saying to them, it was possible to be free. So for my sort of, as I was growing up, I think, well, if they were able to sort of listen to and hear him and follow him, then surely I can do that in my circumstances, which were not as dramatic as what he was dealing with at the time. So I felt he was speaking to me, and I was very, as I learnt about him, I thought, well, he was able to mobilise vast numbers of people and enabled them to recognise their own dignity, that they weren't defined by how other people treated them or what other people thought of them. That wasn't who they were. They were able to stand with great dignity in the face of a lot of intimidation. And violence. But what he did as well was share a vision of humanity. So this is what really also appealed to me. He wasn't just saying to African Americans, you're more than this. Don't be defined by your situations. He was also saying to everybody, we all can be more. We can all connect deeply, beautifully, lovingly together, and actually have experienced our full potential. So he shared a whole vision of how humanity could be. It was almost as if he was saying, really, what we have sort of deep inside our being is a quest for freedom. We all have that, wherever you come from. But hatred and fear will prevent you from experiencing that. So in order to find that quest for freedom, you have to let go of your hatred and fear. And he was saying that to both black and white. So I really found his vision of freedom, of humanity, really very, very beautiful. And he spoke in poetry as well. So in a way, his language was almost through his language, he was elevating people's consciousness, I felt. So I thought I'll read some of his words. So he's sort of now appearing at our gathering. So he says, in the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. I just love that last line, meeting physical force with soul force, and also around hatred. So as I grew up, I saw more and more injustices, actually. It's sort of not just race, it was poverty, it was class, it was lots of things that I just thought, why are we living in a world like this? I could see that people were not able to fulfill their potential because of some of these things. And it was very easy to get angry about it. It was very easy to kind of, in a way, that was my initial response. That was my immediate response. And then to tend to look at others who you thought were creating that situation and then get into sort of hatred. And so Martin Luther King's words were really sort of poignant for me. You know, let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. And it echoes, of course, in a way, what he was saying, that hatred has never ceased by hatred. Hatred can only be ceased by love, which was the words of the Buddha. So I sort of learned that. So every time I sort of would find myself in a state of anger, I sort of would remember that. And I think, okay, that's not actually going to help me. I didn't actually know what to do about it. I didn't necessarily know how to transform it at that time, but I certainly knew that it wasn't going to help me resolve the situations that I was finding myself in. So I'm going to read another bit here. So he says, the famous I Have a Dream speech. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the colour of their skin, but by the content of their character. So that's very famous, those words. And I sort of really, again, spoke to me because I thought, judging by the content of your character. So that means that we can do something. I sort of somehow implicitly understood that that meant that we can do something about our character. That's something we can do something about, and that we're responsible for our character. We're not actually, at least consciously, responsible for the family we're born in, and where we live, and the name we get, and what we look like, all that kind of stuff. That comes before us, if you like. But we can be responsible for how we act, how we behave. So that was very, very clear there. And then he ends with, this is the last bit of his speech. He goes, this is our hope. This is the faith that I will go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out the mountain of despair, a stone of hope. With this faith, we'll be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful sympathy of brotherhood. With this faith, we'll be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that one day we will be free one day. And then we've got that chant that happens, free at last, free at last. God Almighty, we are free at last. So he almost puts people into, it's already happened, this freedom. You've just got to keep going. You've got to keep going with the struggle, and you can't do it by yourself. So there's a very strong collective experience he was trying to generate. People before that were individually, they were trying to you know, cope with their daily struggles. And he was saying, actually, you've got to be a collective. You've got to do it in conjunction with others. It's in conjunction with others that you'll get that strength and you'll get that faith. So I was deeply inspired by that sort of growing up. And it did give me hope, even though I wasn't sure how to enact all of what he was saying. You know, he was long gone by that time, and there weren't any Martin Luther Kings in my local area. But I sort of, his words still sort of resonated very much with me. And he obviously gave people, his followers, courage as well. So the very famous other person who's making a guest appearance is Rosa Parks. She was only 42, actually, when, you know, she did that act of deciding she wasn't going to move to the back of the bus. So she decided she was not going to move to the back of the bus, which was what was she was supposed to do. That she had this burly bus driver, you know, who was shouting at her and saying he was going to call the police. And she just said she was, you know, in what she says is she was tired. But she wasn't tired necessarily physically. It was just that she was just tired of having the humiliation. She just was tired of that. And on that occasion, she thought, I've had enough of that. I'm just not doing that anymore. Then this bus driver sort of towers over her. Probably the police are on its way by that time. All the other people she was sitting with, they all moved. They sort of all scurried away. And she just sat there. And I really like what she says, if I can find that quote. Actually, she had training before that. So she wasn't, I was in a school recently, they were doing Black History Month, so they had a picture of Rosa Parks, and she was like this little old lady. But she was 42, and she was already an activist prior to that. So she actually had training, and the training meant that, in a way, her mind was already familiar with what might happen in those kind of situations. So when the situation arose, her mind, the training in a way, kicked in and she was able to respond. So she says when the bus driver came over to her, this big bus driver, she said, I felt a determination cover my body like a quilt on a winter's night. Isn't that lovely? And I just thought, oh, and it really reminded me of the Buddha, when he talks about higher states of consciousness, he talks about there's four levels of higher states of consciousness called dhyana. And there's the fourth dhyana, which is a very, very noble state to get into. He says it's like covering one's whole body in a white cloth, completely, so that your whole being is suffused with equanimity and concentration. And so if you imagine if you were walking around with this sort of equanimity and concentration, whatever was happening around you, you'd be able to meet it clearly, calmly, and with confidence, yeah? So, I mean, Rosa Parks wasn't really saying that, but I kind of thought she probably did have a certain amount of equanimity going on at that point, because there she was in the space of danger, and she just, sort of surrendered to it, but with confidence. She wasn't going to be pushed around. So I really like that quote. And she also says that she wanted to be a person who stood for freedom so that other people could be free. So she also saw herself like, if I can deal with this, if I can sort of have dignity in the face of this, if I can survive this and still be, positive, still be able to communicate, it shows other people the way. Yeah. So that was Rosa. So I think Martin Luther King would have had a lot in common with my next guest at this dinner party. In fact, Martin Luther King did travel to India and was sort of inspired by Indian philosophy, but he didn't meet my next guest. Their timelines didn't quite, connect. But I think they would have had a lot in common. So my next guest is Dr. B.R. Ambedkar. So some of you will have heard about Ambedkar. And he basically became a Buddhist to escape the oppression of the caste system. So he was born into, and he's actually single-handedly as well, almost responsible for the revival of Buddhism in India. It had pretty much died out in terms of people practicing it en masse. And yeah, he was responsible for that because in him converting to Buddhism, all his followers also converted. Anyway, he was born of one of 14 children into a low caste, ex, well, untouchable, it was called then, and now called Dalit community. So he was born as one of 14 children, and he was the only one, I believe, who actually managed to get an education. I don't know how quite he did it, but he managed to get an education. He obviously was brilliant, he excelled. Actually got to university. He managed to get scholarships to study in America. He also then got to study here. He was studying at London School of Economics. He managed to attain all the highest qualifications you possibly could. And at that point, in a way, the world was his oyster. He could have gone to America. He could have stayed here. He really could have, got any kind of job going, and he could have turned his back on what was happening in India, the situation there. But obviously, he was very committed, and he went back. He went back to India to see what he could do to help. In a way, that already, the fact that he was able to come from such difficult beginnings and get to the highest levels of education and travel the world already shows the possibility of, well, what people can do, yes, and that they can overcome very, very difficult situations. So yes, he could have had this high-flying career. He did actually start at one point, look to set up some business consultancy. He actually set up a business consultancy, which apparently was doing okay until people discovered that the background he came from, and then all his business stopped and the business failed. But he found himself in government, working for government, and he'd clearly freed himself from any sort of low sense of confidence and esteem and all of that. He had a sense of his own worth. However, he was still subject to the sort of daily indignities, really, from his colleagues, who were still discriminating against him. And he had to work in the face of all of that. But because of his intellect, because of his skills, he was drafted to do the to build or to draft India's first constitution. So he's famous and well revered in India today because of that. However, he was fighting. He continued to fight for rights, for women's rights. He fought for women's rights. He fought for more rights for the Dalits. And there was a battle every step of the way. Gandhi was there. Him and Gandhi were sort of were opponents. Gandhi wasn't happy with some of the things that he was suggesting in terms of rights for the Dalits. There was a battle every step of the way, and you get this sense that he's been worn down. He's been worn down gradually by the politics, by the context he's in. At some point, he basically decides that's enough. He realizes that the politics and even all the things he's been doing in the legal system is only going to get him and his people so far. It certainly got them sort of a untouchability band, if you like, but it didn't. But it was still happening. So he saw that actually, in people's hearts and minds, people were still discriminating against, and his community was still suffering from a sense of low self-worth. Yeah. So for him, the only way out was to leave Hinduism altogether, because Hinduism caste really a part and parcel of the Hindu religion. So he decided to leave it altogether, and he converted to Buddhism with the help of Bhante Sangharakshita and other leaders, teachers out in India at the time. And Subhuti, our president, was here last week, and he was talking a little bit about Ambedkar. And this mass conversion that happened. And it's a very moving image, I think, where Ambedkar apparently told all his followers to, you know, they were poor, the poorest of the poor, they were literate, and, you know, sort of dressed in rags, basically. And he told them to, for the conversion, they had to do whatever they should do to wear pristine white. So they, however they did it, they found clothing of pristine white, and they cast aside their rags, and they had these lanterns, and they were going to this mass conversion with all in white with these lanterns. I find that really moving because it's, for me, it's almost like symbolically moving out of the darkness, yeah, moving out of the darkness into something, into a brighter future. And so, yes, they had these mass conversions. And he really symbolically was saying to them that, you know, you have to free yourselves, yeah, free your own minds from the slavery that you've been in. And so I imagine it was an incredible occasion for these people who have been in slavery, really, for thousands of years. I mean, it's the oldest oppressive system, actually, casteism. So I imagine it was very, very powerful. And it reminds me, I mean, Akasha Mitra can help me with this, because it reminds me of a man who came to do a talk once who was working with the Dalit community, Dalit women, whose job was to, well, they were manual scavengers, yeah? And their job was to basically carry, clean out the dry latrines, and carry it in baskets, yeah, to the sort of edge of the village, and that still goes on, doesn't it? Still goes on to this day. And this man was trying to, you know, get these women to realise that they could do more than that with their lives. They were more than that. They could do more than that. Because imagine, it's hard to imagine, I think, the effect it has if you're just brought up knowing that if you cross somebody else's path, just by crossing their path, you'll pollute them. So you're not allowed to drink from the same water, and you can only do the most dirtiest and difficult of jobs. That's all you're there for. So this guy was saying to them, no, you can do much more than that. And he got them to burn their baskets, isn't it, and smash up latrines. And I quite like that sort of image. They sort of had these big bonfires. And for them, again, it was symbolically that they had to do something to sort of show themselves that they were, that was just a construct in a way. Yeah, it was a construct that they could literally take a match to. And then when they've done that, they were free of it. And so this sort of act of dressing in white and having lanterns was the same kind of thing, of kind of symbolically declaring to oneself that there's so much more to one than what you, that your conditions and circumstances have told you. So, and it's interesting, apparently they've tracked the communities who converted, so not all communities converted to Buddhism, but many did, and they've tracked the communities that converted all those years ago to now, and apparently they can see that those communities who did convert, even though the legal system's still similar and people's attitudes are still similar, those communities are economically and socially doing such significantly better than communities that didn't convert. Which I find quite interesting. It's almost like, in a way, they had to have that sort of belief in themselves to make that difference for themselves. So I think Martin Luther King and Ambedkar, if they were at this party together, I think they'd have a lot to say to each other. They would find their common ground, and I think their common ground is this. So they were both able to rise above the limits of their conditioning, you know, very tough, harsh conditioning. And in a way, I think, well, if they can rise above their conditioning, which is amongst, you know, the worst you can get, then in a way, whatever conditioning one has, whether that's difficult family, difficult experiences at work, you know, whatever it is, then it's possible to rise above it. It doesn't have to define you. So that was the first thing that they both have in common. They inspired confidence through being able to do this. Just them doing it for themselves inspired other people around them. And again, in a way, I mean, we've seen that so many times in all different spheres of life, that we had the death of Roger Bannister recently, who broke the four-minute mile. And at the time he did that, everyone thought it was completely impossible that anyone could do that. And of course, now loads of people do it. It was the same with, I learned recently, women were not allowed to run marathons because they thought it'd be bad for them, bad for their health. And the first woman that won a marathon, you know, she sort of sneaked into the marathon, sort of dressed a bit like a guy, and she was running away, and then they realised that she was a woman and they were trying to catch her. and her partner was sort of fending them off. And she managed to finish the marathon, and they were like, oh, well, maybe women can run marathons. So, and now it's commonplace. So, yes, yeah, so in a way, one person doing something shows that it can be done. It's humanly possible, and it gives confidence to others. And, of course, we have the Buddha, who is the exemplar supreme, I think, who was able to show that, it is possible to completely free your minds from greed, hatred and delusion and overcome suffering completely. So we'll come to him later. And they also said, so yes, they showed that they could overcome their own individual circumstances. They were able to inspire others. But they also showed that their individual freedom wasn't enough. It wasn't enough for them to just sort themselves out. And what that sort of sort themselves out and somehow sort of protect themselves from the sort of things that were going on. They saw that that wasn't going to be possible for them. Or they, I think actually freedom of that kind, freedom of heart and mind, actually what that gives you as well is responsibility. Yeah. So what they actually felt was a deep sense of responsibility to others, to people that who are still stuck where they had been. So I find this quite interesting around responsibility, because usually, I don't know how about you, but sometimes we can think responsibility is something that curtails us, that's constraining and not much fun. But actually, it's interesting, because I think if you have greater freedom of heart, which means you're less bound by fear, you're less bound by hatred, you're less torn, if you like, or what's the word, conflicted by your likes and dislikes. You know, we often just go between our likes and dislikes all the time. If that is not your experience, if there's a lot more freedom of heart, then you're going to find yourself, I think, naturally connecting with other people more, yes? There's less barriers between you and others. There's less barriers between you and things that's going on in the world. And if there's less barriers between you and others, then in a way, you're going to feel more for others. You're going to feel more for their situations that they're in. And if you feel more for others, then you're going to want to respond to what you can see happening. Yeah. So it's responsibility in that way. There's a sort of natural desire, wish to respond. So in that kind of responsibility doesn't necessarily feel burdensome. It can feel difficult. It can feel challenging, but it doesn't have to feel burdensome, because actually it's a natural response to caring about another person. Yeah. So they both had that in common, that their ability to free themselves, the fact that they knew it was possible to live more fully and connect more to their potential and realise their potential, they could feel that the need for that in other people, and they wanted to help others. So responsibility and freedom. What else? But that responsibility also means some level of commitment as well. Because what they also have in common is that they saw that that they have to continually work with their mental states in order to respond to others, in order to continually not just feel free and I'm feeling freedom, but to continue to develop a sense of freedom, They had to commit to working on their mental states. And if you read any of King's story, you'll know that wasn't necessarily easy, because, you know, he had threats, he had all kinds of things going on in his life. And, you know, it was very easy to want to either, get angry or retaliate or think, how can I protect myself from what's going on? That's a very natural sort of a response. But he understood that that wasn't going to get him where he wanted to go. So he had to work with his mental states. He had to work with the feelings of fear that arose, the feelings of anger that arose, the feeling of doubt that definitely would arise, particularly because he was trying to get people, even Ambedkar as well, he was mobilising hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. And that's a massive responsibility, isn't it? And you're going to, I imagine, have doubt. Am I doing the right thing? If asking people to leave Hinduism, the religion that they've been born into, that they've only known me, am I doing the right thing? I imagine they would have had some moment of doubt. So they would have had to work with doubt. They may have even had to work with despondency as well, you know, the times when things were not going well. But they were committed, because they had this vision of humanity, which was that it is possible for all people to feel a sense of connection. It is possible for all people to free themselves from oppression, but also to be free to love others, even those who are more wildly different to ourselves. Because they had that vision, they were committed to continually working with their own mental states. Yeah. So that's another thing they had in common as well. So yes, responsibility, commitment, and there would have been a bit of discipline as well there. They would have had to have discipline. I mean, Ambedkar would have found that within the practices of Buddhism. But he died tragically 7 weeks after, I think, something like that, after the conversions. All his followers, again, there's descriptions of all his followers just being completely distressed and distraught, because they looked to him completely for their way out. And fortunately, there were teachers on the ground, including Sangharakshita, who was able to, keep them engaged, keep them mobilised, and actually begin to teach them the practices, teach them the sort of disciplines they needed to actually work with their mental states. So my final guest is John Coltrane. Yes. So I was very inspired by social movements and, what was possible and overcoming oppression and all that kind of stuff. And I sort of got to the point where, I had an education. I felt I had a certain amount of freedom because I was educated, and because actually, if you think about it, we do have a certain amount, most people, not everybody, but most people in the country we're in have a sort of basic level of freedom. Yeah, we're in a democracy, for one thing, and we have a health service, we have basic education. So because of that, if things go all right generally and you don't fall through the gaps, and there are gaps, but if things go all right, you do have a certain amount of choice. So I found myself with a certain amount of choice, although having said that, what you do with that choice, because we have lots of freedom, but what we have is freedom to choose, and that's a privilege really of being in a culture like we're in. But what do you choose? What guides your choices? How do you know that the choices you make are going to be beneficial for you? How do you know they're going to be okay for others, not going to harm others? So we have lots of choice, and often when we think about freedom, when we think about freedom, we often think, well, I want to be free to do what I want when I want, right? That's usually what we think of as freedom. In a way, I kind of think that is freedom of choice. That's what that is. That's freedom of choice. But how do you know what's guiding your choice? And actually, many people are stuck with the choices that are there. I don't know if you know that or you've had that experience yourself where you just think, I really don't know which way to go because I could go this way, I could go that way, I could go this way. And then a lot of that is, well, I don't know what the consequences will be to my what I choose. Yeah. So actually freedom of choice isn't always, I mean, it's great that we have it. It is a privilege. But it actually, to exercise it well, needs quite a lot of thought. And it needs something else actually that guide us to do that skillfully. I say that because in the rambles that Subhuti gave last week as well, he talked about that we can choose things that are unhelpful to us. We can choose things that are harmful to us. That's also the choice that we have. And he reminded us that in Germany, they chose, it was a democracy, and they chose Hitler. They chose Mussolini. The country did that to themselves. So yes, it's not easy to choose. So we have freedom of choice, but what does freedom actually, real freedom, that's that freedom of heart and mind, the freedom that inspired Ambedkar and Martin Luther King, what did that actually feel like? And I think I got to this point in my life. I sort of think, well, I can choose various things. So I have freedom of choice, but I don't know if I feel free. I don't know if I feel particularly a real depth of freedom. What does freedom actually feel like? How do I know I'm becoming more free? So that's an interesting question, I think, that we can keep asking ourselves. How do we know we're becoming more free? You know? As particularly as practicing Buddhists. So anyway, I had lots of choices before me, and I'd been on holiday. I'd been on this long haul flight, and I'd come back and had terrible jet lag, and decided to, I went to bed, and but woke up hours later, unable to move, and I had no sense of what was wrong with me. I just could not move, and if I did try to move, I was in excruciating pain. And it was quite poignant at that time because I had been thinking around, okay, what am I going to do next with my life? Where's my next direction? And suddenly there I was in bed, unable to move. And I realized, well, this might be it. There might not be a future that I'm imagining for myself. And it was quite a scary time, and it went on for weeks, but certainly the acute stage went on for at least a week where I really couldn't move. Gradually, I sort of began to be able to move a little bit, but I was in a lot of pain. And one night I decided I was going to watch a film, and I watched this film that was really, I think that has to get the award for the bleakest film ever. It really painted a picture of humanity at its worst. It's sort of hedonistic, materialistic. It was just violent. It was just awful. I mean, it's won awards, but from my point of view, it was like this awful movie. Awful in the sense that I was in a lot of pain. I'd been in bed for, days, worried, fearful, not sure what my future was. So that was my experience. And then, I thought, let me just watch something on TV. And there was this, this despair on the TV, just writ large. And I just went to bed just thinking, oh, God, this is just terrible. It was like, falling to the bottom of a barrel or something. So I had the radio on when I went to bed, and I left it on. And probably about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up, and I woke up to the most beautiful, melodious, dulcet tones of John Coltrane. Chanting really Love Supreme. It was just, I was going to play it to you tonight, I couldn't get the things to work, but just playing Love Supreme. And he repeats this refrain again and again, a Love Supreme. And it's got a bass at the background, and then it goes into a bit of saxophone. It's just beautiful. And actually, I'd heard that before, it was not new to me, but somehow in the backdrop of me being in the state I was in physically, and a lot of worry and fear, and having watched that terrible film, and waking up in the middle of the night to those words, I felt he was singing, chanting for me. I felt he was giving me a message. And the message was, there is more. There is more than what was on that screen. There is more to even the experience I was in, that sort of experience of pain. It was love that would enable me to meet the suffering that I was in physically. It was love that was the answer to what I'd seen on the screen. And I was just deeply moved by that. And I knew, I knew that he wasn't talking about romantic love. I think I'd heard it before. I thought, oh, he's talking about some woman that he, you know, or something. But I thought, oh, that's really not what he's talking about. He's talking about really unconditional love. He's talking about a love that can transcend limits and can transcend suffering. And that was my sort of a guide, really. I sort of knew then that I was going to go in search of something more. And that's what I did. So I'm very, very grateful to Coltrane. He had to free himself. He had been addicted to drugs. So he had to free himself from that. And then he did have this spiritual sort of awakening, this sort of revelation. And really all his most wonderful music came out of that period. And I'll say a few words of his. So he says, I want to be a force for real good. In other words, I know that there are bad forces, forces that bring suffering to others and misery to the world. But I want to be the opposite force. I want to be a force which is truly good. And then he says, overall, I think the main thing a musician would like to do is to give the listener the many wonderful things he knows and senses in the universe. That's what I would like to do. I think that's one of the greatest things you can do in life. And we all try to do that in some way. The musicians in music is in music. So I really love that thing about give the listener the many wonderful things he knows of and senses in the world. So that's a sense of possibility. That's a sense that life can be beautiful. That's a sense that life can be mysterious even. And through his music, that's what he was doing. And he had to have, apparently he was, I mean, people know him as this sort of musician that really pushed boundaries. And he did push boundaries, but before, in a way, he did that, he really learned the rules, you know. So he really, apparently had this book that he would just walk around with, and he was just constantly learning the tradition of jazz, really. And then he was able to sort of push the boundaries. And through that, what he was doing was really trying to discover what his voice was. What did he really want to say about his own experience? What did he want to say about the world that would be of benefit to the world? It was his own creative expression, but he knew it had a purpose to it. And the purpose was to help people sense what was possible in life. And also he says something about helping people free themselves, helping the world free itself from its hang-ups, he says. So he had a sense that we have lots of hang-ups, there are ways to free oneself, as he had done. And he was trying to find a voice and a way through his music to do that. So yes, and that needed discipline. It needed discipline, but it also needed the ability to sort of be prepared to go into unknown territory, yeah? Be prepared to go, actually, I don't know what I want to say about this, but I want to say something. And let me go a bit further than others have gone or that I've gone before, and then see what emerges. So it needs that sort of courage to kind of go into the unknown. It needs the courage to find out what it is. In a way, stop listening to all the other voices that you may have been listening to, and then discover, well, what is it I want to say? If I really reflect, if I'm really still, if I meditate upon it, what is it that I really want to say? What's true to me? And that's really what he exemplified in his work. So that's Coltrane, and really he gives us a hint of creative freedom. So we've got the vision of humanity from Martin Luther King and from Ambedkar, and Coltrane gives us a sense of creative freedom and what you can do when you have a purpose, you know, how we can use our different skills and talents, whatever they may be, and to serve the greater good. So he gives us a sort of good sense of that. Really gets us to imagine more, really, imagine more about what's possible. And Coltrane also later did also study a bit of Indian philosophy as well. So I think actually the three of them together would have had a lot to say to each other. I think they would have enjoyed each other's company. And what am I at this gathering? I'm sort of listening in, I think. I'm listening in and I'm asking questions. I'm wanting to hear more and more of their experiences. And I imagine I would be pretty deeply inspired and even overawed, really, by the whole occasion. And I'd want to debrief. So I thought I would debrief with another person called Toni Morrison. She's one of my favourite authors. I've been in her company. She's a very, I really like the fact that she speaks with real eloquence. Her writing's very beautiful. She also writes a lot, really a lot about quite heavy suffering as well. But she does so with beauty. Somehow with her language, she lifts those characters up. So they're not defined by their suffering somehow. And there's something transcendent in that. So I would debrief about the whole occasion with Toni Morrison. She's a storyteller, so I like telling stories as well, and I think we'd be able to enjoy that as well. So, in a way, I've given you a little bit of a journey through my early experiences around freedom. So this sort of series is Freedom, the Bigger Picture, Part One, and it's really about my early understandings of freedom right up until Ambedkar, which is where I became. I was a Buddhist when I discovered Ambedkar. And it was very reassuring discovering him because I was at the same time as I was as a Buddhist beginning to learn about higher states of consciousness. I was beginning to learn about what the mind, the potential of the mind. I was beginning to practice, and Ambedkar reminded me that you can do all of that. That's absolutely necessary, and you can still care about the world. And that was really important for me to know that I can still keep growing myself, keep developing myself, exploring consciousness, but also caring about the world. But part two, bigger picture part two, will be exploring a bit more of creative freedom, what that looks like, discovering your own voice, and we'll also be exploring higher states of consciousness. We'll be meeting some new guests, some from Tibet. They'll be giving us some interesting teachings next week. So, look forward to sharing that with you next week. Yeah, thank you.